Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb. I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and a handful of guests tonight as we return back to a classic Thinking Fellows style that we haven't done in over a year at least, and then as a group we haven't done probably in 2 years. And that's we're down in a hotel bar recording a live-ish episode of the show, which is a lot of fun. Every once in a while I have listeners email us in saying, I really miss the sound of lighters and pipe tobacco and whiskey glasses in the background. What happened? What happened to the show? And unfortunately, as more people listen to the show,
what happened is we moved out of a garage into a real house.
Yeah. We moved out of a garage. You can't smoke inside of a house like you can inside of a garage. The whiskey's still there, but the studio got quieter, so the glasses clink less. And
with professionalism comes less outside noise.
Correct. Yeah. So as the show got better, some of that phased out. But it's nice to relax and splash that back in every once in a while. And we are all people who listened to, I don't know what order I'm going to publish these episodes, but we're in Bergen, Norway, and we came here for the Lutheran Study Days conference in Norway. And I'm going to make him really uncomfortable, and he knows this. But I'm going to have the man who's responsible for bringing us out here put on a headset real quick. And his name's Jarle Blindhelm, and he got us out here. So Jarle, can you introduce yourself and then tell everybody what Lutheran Study Days is and why you brought us out here 3 years ago and all that good stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Caleb. My name is Jarle Blindhelm, I'm not responsible for the study days. It's organized by our local congregation and the regional department of the confessional movement in Norway. The reason we started was that me and one of the pastors discussed that conservative young guys seem to seek knowledge from Reformed traditions when seeking answers to the questions they run into, and we thought, why not try to get back what the confessional Lutheranism, which once left Norway, inviting resources from like Jim Nestingen and also John Pless and the guys around the table now, and of course to use the Norwegian confessional theologians like Knud Alsvåg, Jan Bygstad, these guys. So that's how it started. And as I said, we saw you interviewing Jim in a hotel bar, and just for fun, I said, "Why don't you come to Norway to interview, to take an interview?"
So be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. So now we have received more than we could ever dream of.
Well, it's always been sort of fantastic to be out here and a lot of fun. Jim's not here this year, but you guys are going to have him back next year, what I hear.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm grateful to be out here, and I'm glad you joked around with us and invited us out here.
Yeah, and we have been richly blessed by you and Scott coming to record, and this year especially with all of you giving wonderful lectures, and it's a real joy to have you here and listen to you.
Well, thanks. So the episode we'll talk about a little theology today. The episode, as I was listening to all of the talks given at the conference, which the theme centered around the comfort and the consolation of souls, I thought you guys all sort of got down to a vocational level, which seemed, seemed like sort of the right answer. We do that a lot on this. We've had probably, 20 episodes on vocation over the last couple of years on the show, and so I thought maybe we would talk about comfort in in vocation. And that sort of brought my mind to what the closing talk was, which you gave, Dad, which was on the mutual consolation of the brethren. And conveniently, available for pre-order just in the last couple days, is a book on the same subject, right? It's an edited volume that you put together?
Yeah, I'd say the topic of mutual consolation is certainly central in the book, as is multiple authors discussing Small Called Article 3 in there, including one just very good chapter on it by Paul Koch, and then another very good chapter on it by David Ruffner. And then you and I wrote one together on Luther, the friendship between Luther and Melanchthon and mutual consolation. But specifically, the book is on friendship. Even more specifically, it deals with male friendship and the need for male friendship. But
philia?
Yeah. Overarching to that is the idea that friendship falls into the category, in the Christian sense and vocationally, in the mutual conversation of and consolation of the brethren. So the book's called Where Two or Three Are Gathered. It's a collection of essays by, I'd say, everybody probably but Ruffner, people that Rod trained, and I would say you've influenced David Ruffner greatly on the subject of friendship.
Yeah, it's lately I get a lot of emails, telephone calls about podcasting, just as a as an art, I guess I would say. I don't know if I'd call it art, but as a skill from people starting podcasts. I've gotten questions from universities about turning their lectures into podcasts. Did an interview here in Norway about sort of the structure behind podcasting, and a lot of the
guy needs your help because he had technical difficulties. Yeah. And we have to redo the podcast.
Yeah, we do have to redo the podcast, which is no problem at all. I'm happy to do.
I think we'll use our equipment this time.
We will use we'll use my equipment, one of the questions I constantly get asked is, how do you, like, what's the magic of it? How do you get it to happen? And I try to quantify it with some of the measurable things, like,
I'll give you a single word.
Well, yeah, you can do it. Yeah.
Content.
Well, content, but
it's everything.
So, but I was going to say, so, you know, I'll say things like consistency, right? We've picked the right time amount or something like that. But when it comes down to it, the conversations are because of friendship. It's because of the sort of the comfort we have being able to talk with one another. The Thinking Fellows is at its core about, the mutual conversation of the brethren. When we talk about formal theological topics, I think the content is good enough to show up within lectures. But in reality, it's a conversation. The reason that we've had so many people, we have four people on the show or five people on the show, is to keep it intentionally conversational. We don't read from scripts.
Yep.
When we do the show. And part of that is,
well, most of the time you didn't even tell us what we're talking about until we start the show.
I don't. And part of that is about not just a conversation for us, but a way to include listeners within the mutual conversation that they may not have in their daily life, and sort of having a weekly way to do that. So I think this topic, even to me, ties into why do we do the podcast at all whatsoever.
What's funny is we on the show that we have to redo, the some guy that teaches at a seminary in Oslo, I think,
Canute,
who wants to start a podcast, talked to Caleb, me and Adam about this, and he asked, well, how did the Thinking Fellows start? And when I first started working for 1517, one of the things I realized is that a lot of people overlook is the impact that Rod had on the White Horse Inn over his 25 years of being on that show with Mike Horton and Kim Riddlebarger. And that he had he wasn't on the show as much. He wasn't on White Horse Inn as much anymore, and that people missed his voice. And that I started thinking about, in my new job as director of 1517, what can we do to get Rod's voice out there? And which led me to think, what is Rod's voice actually meant to so many people throughout the years. And as we were just talking about before the show, what it's done is it's produced, he said it himself, it's produced, you know, 7, 9, 10 other people that are like him that have gone on to do advanced degrees or become pastors that were greatly influenced by him. And so then when the idea of the podcast came up, it was pretty easy to say, well, we need to have people on there on the show that have been impacted by Rod and that are friends, and so that this mutual consolation came in. And I was saying that when Adam and I were in undergrads, and even after, Rod would every Saturday night host a very, it seemed, he's explained it to me since, that it seemed more informal than it was probably to me, event at his house every Saturday night. Where the guys would get together and there'd be food and drinks and we'd talk, you know, theology, politics, philosophy, family, life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, multiple stories. And it seemed like it'd always be great to just like drop a microphone in the middle of that table and record the conversations that were going on. Now, some of them could never hit the airwaves, otherwise there'd be trouble. But some of them would be very beneficial. And I thought, well, what if we took the beneficial ones and made them into this podcast? And it, you know, at the time when we started the podcast, Joy and I and Autumn had moved close to Adam and Rachel because, you know, we were moving off campus and wanted to be near friends. And so we moved to San Juan near their house, and we literally lived right down the street from each other. And Adam's a historian, which brought another dynamic to it and the friendship. And from then on, you know, whether it's been just the four of us or the guests that we bring in, new friends, old friends, it's been about friendship. It's been about this mutual conversation. And I think people pick up on that, which is why I think you sometimes get the emails that they miss the old feel. I don't think that they miss the drinks as much as they sort of miss the feel that we're still in Rod's backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think, I don't know. There's something about it. And again, it's, I didn't imagine, I guess when the project started for me, that would be one of the big values the podcast had outside of, you know, theological education and catechetical ability or something like that.
Those days in the garage with dogs barking,
yes,
or lawnmowers, the Marine Corps flying their helicopters overhead. Or
yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Those were the good old days.
I still remember sitting at Wahoo's, which is a great taco place near the church that we all used to attend after church with you and Rachel when Joy and I were going to be moving off campus and saying, well, we need to find a place to live. And you said, well, there's a place for rent right up the street from us. And we literally went that day
to go look
at it and had it rented within like 3 or 4 days.
We planned on not moving for 2 months.
Yeah, it was great.
We just moved.
It was 326 yards away.
Yeah, it was.
I had it all dialed in with my spotting scope.
Yeah.
just kidding.
Well, I know in the case of the White Horse Inn, I was there at the behest of Dr. Horton, and he looked at me and said, I don't want this to be another purely reformed operation. I want LCMS at the table, and that means you. I said, fine. So I was a guest at a reformed table, and some of the things that people said along the way was, related to the verse about when he comes, he will neither break the bruised reed nor quench the smoldering wick. And somehow they heard that in my voice, and I was always looking for those who were being broken
by
the church.
Yeah, I remember the old, this is a show on the White Horse Inn, but I remember the feel of the old shows. You know, where you guys would get callers and where you would sort of Do you remember that, Adam? Yeah. You'd tune in at like 9 o'clock at night on KKLA mm-hmm. and listen yeah. to it.
Sometimes I'd have to, in my car, I'd have to go to a certain yep. spot to get the reception.
Many,
yeah, yeah.
Many people, that's right. Yeah. They got into their car and got to where the signal was strong enough they could listen.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to extend the microphone to Steve Peach, Stephen Peach, who... you flew from Australia to the conference, so I'll have you introduce yourself. You got to join us for a live podcast this afternoon, and maybe you could tell everybody where you're from in Australia and what you do over there.
Okay, I'm from Adelaide, South Australia, and I'm the director of formation at Australian Lutheran College, which is a which is the tertiary education provider, training institution for the Lutheran Church of Australia. And we don't just train pastors, we also train lay church workers, diaconal workers, and a certain number of Lutheran teachers who go to teach in Lutheran schools. Lutheran Church of Australia is a small church in Australia. We have somewhere around 25,000 active members in Australia. So we're a small church in a very big country.
Yeah.
And our congregations in Australia are spread right across that vast continent, and there's also some in New Zealand. One of the things that I think is a wonderful part of our history and a wonderful part of the work that we do at ALC is that we also have a very active ministry teaching a group of Aboriginal Indigenous Australian pastors in Central Australia.
Wow.
So probably twice a year, sometimes three times a year, one of us faculty members goes into the centre of Australia and we camp literally in the middle of nowhere with a group of up to 30 Aboriginal pastors, and we teach them, often four language groups, and we teach through interpreters. It's an absolutely exhausting week.
Yes.
Of course, you're camping in the middle of nowhere, and you sleep in what's called a swag. Does anybody know what a swag is?
No.
A swag is like a little miniature tent. So you sort of roll it out and you crawl into it. It's like a sleeping bag with a roof on it.
Well, like a bivvy like car.
Like a bivvy, yes. Yeah. So we do that about twice a year, and we do that with an organisation called the Fink River Mission, which is a historic mission endeavour of the Lutheran Church of Australia. Right back in the 1800s, I think the 1840s, four Lutheran pastors from Hermannsburg Mission Institute in Bavaria went from Germany to Central Australia. Think of that journey. It makes Australia to Bergen look, like a walk in the park. So these guys went to Central Australia. They started this mission with Aboriginals and Indigenous people in Central Australia. And that's been a long-term historic mission that we've had. And it's still a live thing today. And our seminary, our college, is involved in that training. And that's one part of our work that I'm very proud of and very thrilled to be involved in on a rotational basis. But so I'm the director of formation at ALC in Adelaide, and I also lecture in pastoral care and counselling, homiletics, liturgics, Lutheran confessions, and
wow,
anything else that Whoa. Happens to be going.
Oh.
So yeah, it's great fun. And my area of theological interest and my passion is really Luther studies, particularly Luther's pastoral theology and practice, because I think that it's very important to know that Luther's pre-modern or early modern ideas about how to take care of human beings with the gospel has a lot to say to our post-modern world.
Uh-huh.
And particularly in relation to the fact that he deals with whole people, and he deals with them as whole people, as bodies, minds, imaginations, conscience, everything. And I think that Luther's, one of the famous quotes about Luther, I forget who it was, he said it at the first LWF conference that was ever held in 1947, I believe it was. I think it was Anders Nygren, the great scholar. Was he a Norwegian? Swedish. Swedish, okay. So in the neighbourhood. He said forwards to Luther. We are always catching up to Luther. Mm-hmm. You know, however you want to interpret that. I think in the pastoral area, this is a very important thing, and I think we have a lot to learn from Luther.
Could I ask a question that will betray my ignorance?
Mm.
Why did Sasse, after Erlangen, select Australia?
I'm not a Sasse expert by any means, and I never met him. I know the spot where his house burnt down and where he tragically died in that house fire.
Mm.
But with Sasse, I think there weren't many places left for him to go. And that's a sad thing to say. And he also, Sasse wanted to go where he could do some good, where he could do some teaching and help a Lutheran church be, in the biblical Lutheran sense, evangelical,
mm-hmm.
and biblical and confessional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it says a lot about the humility of the man that he went to Australia.
I see.
Yeah.
I remember when I was at the Springfield Seminary, I would see on the president's desk handwritten letters. He corresponded with Sasse, Jack Preuss, who was later the president.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in letter conversation with some degree of regularity, and I thought, how interesting.
Yeah.
How interesting.
Sasse was a prolific correspondent, okay. And he also, one of the things about him was that he also had this enormous fund of historical wisdom which he could convert into important and perceptive judgments about what was going on in the church across the world at the time.
Uh-huh.
You know how you have some people who can convert the historical knowledge into historical wisdom.
Uh-huh.
And I think Sasse was one of those rare people. He's a legend in our church, and I'm continue to be surprised about how universally Sasse's work is known and respected around the world. Mm. Because I grew up with the idea that he was just this old gentleman,
yes.
who
yes.
lived in North Adelaide.
Yes.
One of my lecturers, Dr. H.P. Harmon, used to call Dr. Sasse the old spider. Because he said, you know, Sasse would be hovering there in his corner of the room and somebody would say something stupid. And that was like a fly landing on his web and he would go... Bah, 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 bah. But it's amazing. One of the great essays of his which I've read a number of times... It's one of the best things on prayer from a Lutheran perspective I think you could ever read is an article he wrote, I think in the early 1960s, I can't be certain, but it's called Ecclesia Orans, the Praying Church, and he talks about the role of prayer in the church via the liturgical prayer of the faithful, the prayer of the church, and he actually sort of provides an ecclesiology through the lens of prayer in this article. And I think it's one of the most brilliant things he ever wrote. And, it's a great masterpiece. Other people have their own favourite Sasse pieces. I'm sure probably somebody...
We publish a collection of Sasse's letters and articles too. It's a pretty thick collection. It was put together by Matthew Harrison.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Matt Harrison.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yes, I know that piece. Yeah.
I once inadvertently sold a copy of This Is My Body. with his autograph.
No more beer
cover.
For you.
Oh, Adam.
Yeah.
No.
It was one of those days when I was weeding out all the theology books and converting my library to a history.
Oh, no. One of the things that I think is important about conferences like this one or what we try to do at Here We Still Stand is there's a lot of time left for talking and eating and drinking that I got used to not seeing at theological conferences, right? It was usually start in the morning, papers, 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 lunch, papers, 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 go to bed. And I was talking to the pastor of the church here, Jan, and he said one of the reasons that this conference is so important for him is that so many people here feel lonely. They feel like they are alone in sort of their Lutheranism and in their confession, and that this gives them an opportunity to not just learn, but to not be alone. And so, again, that brought me back to how important vocationally that this mutual conversation is, and surprisingly how rare it is. Theology is one of those things that isn't always comfortable for people, and I've been saying this more and more on the show. I think it's because everybody you meet, whether they believe they do or not, has a theological opinion. Your view of the world in one way or another has some theological implications, whether you're a Christian or not, whether you're a believer or not. And those opinions are seen as some of the most taboo things to discuss in modern culture. It's sort of an infringement on somebody's rights to disagree theologically, when in fact we need the exact opposite of that. We need more conversation even when we disagree in those particular areas, which I actually think, Adam, this is sort of where your area of expertise leads with the apologetic issue, is that I think one of the reasons people are not willing to have the conversations, because everybody has a different opinion, is because when somebody has an objection, it sort of just turns into a feelings conversation, because it feels like there's nothing substantial to talk about.
Yeah. Is there a question there?
Well, or maybe a jumping off point for you to go on.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how to jump off here. In the, I don't know, it's 21st century, in the so-called postmodern age, people think very differently than the four of us do.
I'm glad there are people who think.
I mean, some people would probably describe our worldview as pre-modern.
Sure.
I'm sure they would.
Which I'm kind of proud to have a pretty honorable view, but
amen.
It's tough. You know, the stuff that Dr. Rosenblatt trained us in, and Dr. Montgomery, it's the pinnacle of apologetic training. But then you go into a context where it's all feelings, and and for me, you know me. Yeah. I don't have a whole lot of feelings. I'm almost dead inside. So it's hard. I don't want to talk about facts and verification, falsification. And, and that's more often than not the place to start.
Yeah.
So I think it was you interviewed, I can't remember who it was. I wasn't part of it, so that's why I don't remember the name. But the conversation, the apologetic conversation, oftentimes in a so-called postmodern context, is should maybe start with, who do you say that Jesus is? Because it's hard to disagree with, or it's hard to deconstruct a person.
Did we do that with Donovan?
No, I don't think it was Donovan. I wasn't there. I've just heard second, third hand. But one of the things that I did learn, and that I'm still trying to sort out, is in the realm of apologetics, you don't own the conversation. You don't set the agenda. You don't get to ask the questions.
Yep.
The starting point is always the person who's objecting, or who's asking you for the reason for the hope within you. And so learning you it t- Dr. Rosenbaum would probably use this analogy. You got to, or this picture, you got to get your nose bloodied a couple times to be comfortable in that sort of circumstance. Because I don't know, we're here in Norway. I don't know what it's like in Norway. I think Scott said he's going to migrate here earlier, but in America, you know, and I imagine it's the same. It's the same the Western world over. You have no idea what you're stepping into in any circumstance in terms of how people view the world, and so you got to be really fast and loose on your feet. Luther, all the way back in the 16th century, said something like this in his Galatians lectures. Hmm. When you're engaging in, he used the term religious controversy, or at least that's how it's usually translated. Whether you're talking with the Jew or a Turk or a heathen or a sectarian, you have to be as subtle and wise as a controversialist. That's kind of clunky language, but as possible. You don't have the comfort or the ease of just quoting a biblical text. It's no longer an argument over the interpretation of the Bible.
No.
But you're in it, as he put it, a totally different arena.
Uh-huh.
And the starting point, you don't get to set it.
Yep.
That's the difficulty of apologetics, and in many ways it's kind of an art, and it probably takes Dr. Rosenbaum can speak to this, a lifetime to sort this out.
Well, I had a context that was predictable, though. The skepticism was the filtering down of the philosophy at Oxford and at Cambridge and Wittgenstein. So I'll give you an example. I was debating a Chinese gentleman, head of the philosophy department, I think, at Mount Palomar or one of the other ones. So I came, gave my paper, and sat down. And he came to the microphone, and he looked at me and said, "Are you capable of out-of-body travel?" I said, "No."
He said, "My spiritual gift."
And then he said, "Are you prescient?" And I said, "No, I'm not." He couldn't figure out how, before I heard his paper, I had answered it.
Mm.
But the answer was simple. Mm. I went to see where he did his doctoral work.
Mm.
Can I ask a question about apologetics? And I'm very aware of the fact that you said, Adam, earlier in a conversation, I forget where it was, I think it might have been in the panel discussion, that you don't think there's a whole lot of room left, or it's perhaps not as good an idea as it used to be attacking in the world of apologetics. But do you think that there's still some role for that classic kind of Socratic questioning?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
How would you use that positively in apologetics?
I can give you a name.
Mm-hmm.
He's evangelical. Greg Kochel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tactics.
Mm.
The book is Tactics, and it's available on YouTube too, I think.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And I think you can, I don't know if he'd want us to do this, but if you just Google Kochel and Tactics, he's got a little summary of that book. Some basic questions that you should.
I would love to be able to do that, but I would have to study it. It doesn't come naturally to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very pedestrian summary of his approach. The point he makes is Christians are no longer in the driver's seat culturally.
Yeah.
He doesn't say they need to learn to shut up, but kind of he says, get off your soapbox or your megaphone or whatever and stop assuming you know what the person you're talking to believes, and just start asking them what they believe, and keep on asking them so that they're disclosing their worldview. And you're not, in a way that you're not telling them what they are supposed to believe, right? And then over time, as they're laying out their worldview by asking certain questions, learning where to discern or what questions you might ask that could, not in a nasty way, but kind of expose some of the shallowness of their reasoning.
Yeah.
Of course, this all assumes people want to be reasonable, you know. And then I think the last thing he suggests is the question, when you let them do all the talking, you ask them, well, how did you come to that position?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I after I read the book Tactics, I thought, maybe I'll try this out. And on a plane, I sat on a plane, three-hour ride with next to a Mormon couple, some guy in the order of the high priest Melchizedek or whatever it is in the Mormon tradition.
Yep. Mm.
And friendly guy. We still, my wife's sitting here, we still get Christmas cards from him 20 years later.
Wow.
He sent me the quad, you know, the four other books put together in leather. I mean, really nice guy. And I thought, well, I'm going to try the Coco approach. And just started asking him questions. He just keeps on telling me more and more about Mormonism, stuff I've read about.
Sure.
But he'd always, as he got deeper and deeper into it, he would preface it by saying, and you're going to find this really strange. And he'd tell me about the planet Kolob or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he spoke for 2.5 hours. I said, all this is fascinating. I want to say goofy, but fascinating. Or interesting, as the British would say it, so they don't judge. can you? I'm curious about one thing. You're a lawyer. I learned he was a lawyer over our conversation. On what basis do you believe all this? And his response was fascinating. He says, "Well, I am a lawyer. This is me summarizing it. I'm trained to follow the evidence, but when it comes to my religious thinking, I follow my heart." And it gets into the whole burning in the bosom stuff and so on.
And Muslims, two types of language stuff.
And I have had this happen in mosques where I've had informal and formal conversations with Muslims where when it comes down to it, you ask them, well, why do you believe these things about Jesus? Namely, that he didn't die on a cross, which is a pretty popular Muslim opinion. And they'll say things like, well, as a Muslim, I'm committed to the Quran, even though the historic facts say something different. And when you get into that arena, you're in the realm of ideology, and it's really hard to make any sort of progress there. Mm. But exposing other views as ideological thinking in a nice way, with gentleness and respect, the stuff that Dr. Rosenblatt and I are masters of, exposing that stuff, that dogmatism, and not being dogmatic or ideological yourself, I think that's, if you can expose that, that's pretty, that's a, I don't mean this in a literal sense, but that's a win.
I was going to say on the, back when I was full-time at the university, the class that I basically taught was the intro to Christian theology course. Mm. And do, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3 sections of that course every semester. And, you know, we'd get 25 students in each class, and easily, I'll say 25% of the students were non-believers, probably more. And apologetically, what I'd find with those students is one of the most difficult things right now apologetically isn't that they don't believe, or it's not like an objectionable unbelief like what Dr. Rosenblatt was dealing with in the 70s, 80s, you know, when he's doing these debates. It's just an apathy to truth. Mm. And some people will say in postmodernism that there is no truth and that they don't believe in truth. It's all relativism. I don't believe that as much as I just think they don't care.
Mm.
You know, I don't think that the in general your common sort of postmodern young adult doesn't believe in truth. They just don't really care about truth as much as they care about, you know, what they saw on Instagram or whatever. And that's difficult apologetically, because as far as how, you know, in general we're trained, it's evidential, you know, and you're trying to convince somebody of a capital T style truth that has enough evidence that you can, in a probable fashion, hold to it securely. And that's just difficult. One of the things that I started doing was just starting from a very personal standpoint. Rod introduced us to a book by James Sayer called Know Why You Believe, or Why Believe Anything at All.
Why Believe Anything at All.
And, you know, that's been very helpful to me with young adults because it's helped me sort of, in a Socratic way, ask them to identify for me, the professor, three or four things of great importance that they believe to be quote unquote true. And then for me to ask them why they believe it so that I can sort of expose their sources of authority, like Adam tried to do with the Mormon. And then from that say, well, you actually do care about truth. You actually do hold an epistemology. Here's the epistemology that you're working with. That's how this fits into sort of the greater realm of, you know, how knowledge has been acquired through the centuries, how that sort of fits into truth claims in general.
The great conversation.
How that fits in. But it's the difference, I would say, is that it's not something that you can do over the course of a three-hour debate. It takes a lot of time.
And to tie it back to what I said we were originally going to talk about, which who cares? It's a starting point that treats them as equals, where the conversation is mutual, where, like Adam said, we're not in the driver's seat anymore, not being on the attack, not being on a soapbox, but sort of just allowing people to speak. And that's that Socratic method, that questioning, assumes that the people engaging in questioning each other have some sort of equality. And the Christian knows that that equality isn't just sort of in sort of a natural human right, but is one in Christ. And the ultimate goal is to then get that person to see that as well, and not, and to be able to rejoice in that being a mutual brother in Christ then from there. So, well, I mean, that's 40 minutes. So that's
Well, I just want to say thanks to Stephen for joining the conversation in both podcasts. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to hear your lectures.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
And thanks to the Delt congregation here in Bergen for bringing us out. If you're a listener in Europe, you have a year from now to prepare for the 2020 version.
Yeah, blow this thing up next year.
And people from Germany and the UK and things like that, things that are short flight. I think the fifth biggest country that we have listeners in is the United Kingdom, and it's only, what, an hour and 20-minute flight? So might be pretty doable for people. Great. So thank you for listening to this episode. Thanks for joining us in the bar for our casual conversation, sort of like the past. And we will catch you next time with a more regular episode of the Thinking Fellows.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty. Bye.
Bye-bye.